dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Hey, what's up, people? This is Jamar Tisby, president of the Witness of Black Christian Collective and co-host of the podcast Pass the Mic. Thank you for listening. This week is a very special week. All of our weeks are really exciting and special, but I especially love it when we get new guests, new sort of semi-temporary co-hosts, whatever you want to call it. And today we have the amazing, the incredible, the hilarious, the intelligent Adam Keeley.
Oh, wow. That's dope, man. I like that. You gave me the old Bulls 96 intro with my last name. I like that, man.
You know, I grew up around there. I was right there with the Bulls in the 90s. But yeah, man, we're so excited to have you. If folks listened to our, I don't know if we actually posted the Squadcast, or was that exclusive to the Pass the Mic Live event?
Yeah. It might have been, you know, Bo always likes to keep some stuff in the vault. Uh-huh. So, you know what I mean? He might be sitting on that
one. So only the people who attended our Pass the Mic live event in New York City may have heard you before. You were on the Squadcast with Elodie, and Bo did a phenomenal job. And we've wanted to have you on the mic for a while now. So, brother, for folks who don't know you, tell us about yourself.
Oh, man. Thanks for that. Yeah, I'm a comedian and a tour producer. You know, can follow me on Twitter at AO Keezy. Follow at your own risk. Shout out Tyler. comedian and tour producer from the great state of Florida and Chicago. I'm just trying to do comedy, and I think similar, just, you know, from my perspective as a believer, and then partner with other great people to create great events and things like that to just get out their messages and get out their work. So that's usually always what I'm trying to do. My sort of theme that I always tell myself is I like to create more space than I occupy. So I like to perform, but then I like to open up more space for other people to do their thing as well.
Yo, how does a Christian do comedy, man?
Most of them not too well. you get saved and you get dry. You know what, man? I think, like, at least my own experience and some other people that I have been connected to, it's just the lens, man. I feel like you really have, like, sort of the pastoral lens to do it really well. You know what I mean? You observe the world the same way as a pastor. But then you just kind of are able to just sort of pick fun at the nuances. I think a lot of times, Christians in comedy, they get caught up in, they kind of want to sound like a Bible summer camp or something like that. When it's just, instead of just like kind of like talking about the realities of the day to day of like walking through as a believer and what that looks like. And I feel like when we deal with the real authentic corners, like everything that the Witness does in the same way, it's just like a comedy version of that. And that's what makes it work, you know?
Man, I love it. Was there a moment that you knew you were funny and like you could make people laugh and maybe wanted to not necessarily take this on as a vocation, but like everybody tells a joke here and there. Everybody tries to be funny here and there. How did you know that like comedy was your thing?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing I talked to my friends about. The earliest, I think it started off just performing in general. I was young. I think this was like the 90s, and I had gotten this like red Michael Jackson jacket with all the zippers on it. Remember that joint that Mike had?
Yes.
Yeah. And I also had a keytar for Christmas. So like the guitar with the piano thing. And like every Christmas and holidays, I would just be with my family. And I was always just performing for them. Everybody would ask me to do something and they would record me and I'll sit around and clap and laugh. And then, you low key get addicted to the feeling. You know what I mean? Just like everybody just laughing. But yeah, I just remember with that Michael Jackson jacket on performing Michael Jackson for my family, all my aunts and uncles and my older cousins. And then we used to roast a lot. And so just being able to come out on top of those roast battles kind of let me know that I was cut out for it a little bit.
Bro, you with the keytar, I'm picturing I'm picturing what's the one with Gru and Minions?
Wait,
Despicable Me 3.
Yeah.
The third Despicable Me, I think that's the villain in there.
I was nice with it, man.
The rat tail. All right, man. Well, you know, we could do a whole episode just kind of interviewing you and your take on comedy and culture and whatnot. But I figure we spend this episode kind of talking about events that are current as we record. Yeah. It has been an incredibly busy week, couple of weeks, as it has been since like 2016. It seems like there's way too much news to keep up with. But before we get into some of the political stuff that happened, there was an incident. Well, it was is a sad thing. This rapper named XXXTentacion.
Yeah,
he was killed. Can you fill us in a little bit about that?
Yeah, he was killed. He's a guy from around me. I think he's from Deerfield Beach, which is in South Florida. He had a really troubled life. That ended in obviously his random act of violence where he was robbed and shot down there in Florida. But I think the bigger controversy outside of just the unfortunate passing is he was a very troubled guy. He had been in trouble for domestic abuse against his girlfriend who was pregnant at the time, physically assaulting her, and then also physically assaulting just other people in different situations. And I think the main conversation around his passing was sort of like, how do we feel about people that may not, you know, they have some bad tendencies, you know, like how do we feel about them passing? What does it look like? Like, you know, a lot of people were pretty upset with people for either just like honoring him and missing his music. And then other end was people just being completely callous and like, hey, this dude is an awful guy. He's beating up pregnant women. He's beating up, you know, people from the LGBT community. You know, this is not necessarily something that we should be sad about, which really raised some really interesting points, I thought, and processing.
Yeah.
That.
And it should be noted. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, this dude was physical. He was violent. He had a court case ongoing, even up to the moment that he was killed. So it's not like little character flaws here and there. This brother was wreaking havoc, toward the people in his life, and it was really, really bad. And so, yeah, like you're saying, it leads to questions about, well, how do you sort of remember him in life and in death, right? Like, he makes music that a lot of people really liked. So that fire being extinguished is sad in a sense. And then, of course, just being a human being, obviously, any image bearer from a Christian point of view, you don't celebrate their death no matter how bad they were. It's just like, but I don't know. You know, how do you talk about him, especially because a lot of people tried it out like he was trying to turn it around, donating to charity, doing some good things. So, I mean, just how do you like personally parse this?
Yeah, I think it's definitely made me think of a few things. And I would say I also sort of aggregated his passing with like the passing of Anthony Bourdain, which is just a couple of weeks ago. And it just, the two things that it made me think of is one, just like, when we, you know, in the absence of a relationship with the Lord, people will deify humanity, right? And the problem with deifying humanity is that it's so finite, right? You look at a guy like Anthony Bourdain, and he essentially lived the life that social media told us would make us happy, right? He invested in people. He traveled, he ate all the best food, you know what I mean? And he was really, and he wasn't like an elitist. He was out here really like, he wasn't appropriating and things of that nature. And the same thing with XXX, he was, you know, a young guy who was speaking his truth and making his art, and he was successful straight out the gate. He had no student loans, you know what I mean? Like, he was, you know, had the adoration of millions of people. So, you know, society tells us that this should be enough for us. This should be enough. When really it isn't. And so it really makes me happy that, when it comes to things of that nature, especially, you know, going back to X and his passing, is that like the need for a judge who is separate of the way that we view humanity is ever. Yeah. It's so clear. You know what I mean? We're sitting here debating about whether he deserves to be, you know, remembered, or how do we take it? And I'm just like, man, I'm so glad that there is someone who is bigger and outside of all of this, who is incredibly gracious, and then also will just drop the hammer at a moment's notice, who is in charge of this. Because if it was left up to us, I mean, you see, like, this is what you see online, and the way we're unpacking it, that's us at our best. And it was awful the way we were unpacking it. So it just really makes that God's role in our life as judge is so clearly,
I mean, I think of important. The Old Testament, and so often it'll pronounce an epitaph on somebody's life, right? And it doesn't matter, like, the things that we see as big and important, God's like, nah, that's not how I do it. And so, you know, as a sort of an opposite example, King David, right, who commits adultery, murders the woman's husband, but he repents, and when he dies, he's still called a man after God's own heart, right? And that's,
which is crazy.
Yeah, it's wild, right? So, but it gets to the question of how will you be remembered? And I think for me, it sort of presses the obligation and the responsibility to have what the Bible calls a good name. I think of Proverbs 22. It says a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. And so the Bible makes it real clear, like, to have a good name, a positive reputation, being trustworthy, a person of upstanding, upright character, that's more important than being rich, more important than being famous. And that's what lasts way longer than those kind of material things.
Definitely. Yeah, that's crazy. Just how will you be remembered at the end of the day?
And man, so, that's crazy. You know, peace to Triple X. He was only 20, I think.
20 years old, just, man. A kid. I was, yeah. Just a kid. Yeah, it's crazy. But then also, you know, you know, we're at a point in our time where it's just like, man, we can't, you know, women's bodies are not part of the process of becoming a mature man.
That's the issue, like, right there. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
So much of what's popular in hip hop and rap today is just riddled through with misogyny, misogynoir, patriarchy, horrible sort of depictions of women. And I don't know what to do, man. I don't know. Like, can we stage a boycott big enough to impact this? Do we just cancel all these rappers which would be like almost every rapper, right?
All of them. Right?
I mean,
all
the what's your view on that? Do you listen to it? Is there an action plan? Is it just is what it is?
You know what, you know, referring back to one of the things that Tyler says, like, you know, I'm not like everybody else. I wasn't always saved. So I got a little bit of a testimony in me. You know what I mean? Being from the South, we have a certain brand of hip hop that is notoriously a little bit ratchet, I would say. So I grew up just completely desensitized to it. It was just like, oh, it's just music. It's just hip hop. You know what I mean? It's not like, there's sort of a shallowness or vapidness to it. It doesn't mean what it's actually saying. They're empty words. But then it gets to a point where you're just like, you know, maybe we should start being accountable. And I look at it as a performer and a creator. Like, there's a thing in comedy where they always tell you to when you write a joke, you can talk about anything if you talk about it at the top of your intelligence, right? Essentially, any joke that doesn't come across well is probably a joke that wasn't delivered intelligently, right? And that is what we balk at. That's when it's a little rough. And so I think, in a weird way, and this is not to take away from the fact that we need to protect women, because we need to protect women at all costs, but I think in a weird way, we just need to push people to be better artists. You know what I mean? It's just like, just, you know, push yourself to talk, you know, don't settle for the low hanging fruit of appealing to like this, like crassness in us. You know what I mean? Like, hip hop is beautiful music. It's powerful political music. Just push yourself to have great content. Push yourself to, to make. You know, the greatest hip hop, the funny thing about rap and hip hop is the greatest songs of all don't really include that stuff.
Dear Mama.
You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, right. I mean, you talk about I Choose You, right? About like Outkast, and it's like, it's the exact opposite. You know what I mean? We love that song. And it is a song is about a man, you know, stepping into the calling of being, you know, monogamous and being set apart for one woman. So I think something inside of us, even though like, you know, there's the like McDonald's fast food effect of the sort of rawness of songs, it's just more beautiful for people to just kind of be on that home cooked, you know what I mean?
Right,
whatever chef level with their work. So I just think that's what it is. It's just like, yo, you know, don't, you know, pull your money away from it because money is the ultimate thing. You know what I mean? With record labels, if people aren't paying to hear it, they're going to tell you to stop talking about it.
Right.
And just push people to be better creators. You know what I mean? That's at the end of the day.
You trying to say be best?
Yeah, right. Yeah, amen.
But just to complicate it a bit, like I was a middle school teacher and principal, right? And so you got these 12, 13, 14-year-old boys coming in, trying to learn to be grown and whatnot. And there are two things to them that I noticed. There's a pattern. This just could be my school or my students or whatever. But the pattern was to be a man, you had to be tough, which meant getting a fight if you had to, like physically tough, you know. And then, and then the other way you show you're a man was you sleep with women. You get a lot of women.
Sixth,
seventh, eighth graders, right? And there's a whole culture in a context around it that says, like, there's for a lot of my students, there was no alternative narrative. You know what I'm saying? There were nothing close to them to where it was coming from somebody where they would trust it or listen to it. And I don't want to paint with too broad a brush or talk about, you know, pathologies of poverty or anything like that. I'm just saying, as a school administrator trying to get students to respect one another, when you drill down to it, that's how boys looked at it. And then, of course, females, too, had their own sort of perceptions of womanhood that had a lot to do with sexuality and whatnot. So, I mean, it's a much bigger, like on one level, definitely let's put our money where our mouth is. But at the same time, we've got a whole, and that's not just, you know, students or middle schoolers. This is adults. I mean, think of the Me Too movement. Think of how many folks are getting booted out of office for sexual improprieties and harassment and assault, all of this stuff. So there's like an epidemic problem and music, you know, it's always a question of, you know, does art influence the culture? Does culture influence art? I don't know, but definitely what we're seeing, I think, with music and rapping and hip hop, as far as their views of women, is coming out of a whole culture that has completely messed it up in terms of the image of God in females.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's like chipping away at it, and then there's like unrooting and unearthing the whole thing. You know what I mean? Just like throw the whole thing away. You know what I mean? And like restart it. Yeah, it definitely hints on that idea of just like, you know, regrounding it, especially like, I mean, and God is so amazing at that, man. Like just, you know, just making you clean and new in spite of, you know what I mean? And I don't think that's just an individualistic thing. I think if we collectively move in that direction, that we can have just a rewiring of the way that we process that. You know what I mean? Cause it's not like, I remember being in high school and feeling like I was lame because I wasn't necessarily trying to get at a whole bunch of girls, you know, like, you know, like something is wrong with me or I'm whack. And it's just like, I wasn't whack. Like I was the realest one of all, you know what I mean? Like, but, you know what I mean? But you know,
if only you knew that.
Right. Exactly, right.
Yeah, man, that's a word. Like this is a way bigger conversation and whatnot. And so, you know, apologies. We didn't do the topic justice, but we did just want to talk about extentation and his passing and what all that meant and the bigger issues attached to it. But there's been some other stuff going on, too. Yeah. Kind of funny, kind of sad. One of those things where you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I believe it was in San Francisco. A white woman called the police on an 8-year-old black girl who was selling bottled water, apparently without a permit.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, that became a hashtag and a meme.
Yeah, yeah.
The hashtag was Permit Patty.
Permit Patty.
And it made a whole bunch of memes. So, like, why is this in the news even?
Hey, you know what? It's in the news because it's about time it should be in the news, right? You know? Oh. It's about time. It's, look, they're, you know, we're at a point in the dealings with, like, race in America where we're talking about high-level stuff, and then we're talking about the really nitty-gritty nuances, you know, when you talk about microaggressions and stuff like that. So I'm just like, you know, I think there's some people that are sort of paying the price for the brunt, like, for generations of whatever, you know, like, this woman is, you know, losing her company slowly and losing, like, a lot of her clients and stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, we're talking about that rewiring thing, you know, that, like, you know, like, black bodies are not at the expense of white comfort. You know what I mean? And it's just like, that's gotta go. You know what I mean? That idea that, like, cause I saw that some companies have gotten in contact with her, or some articles or news agencies have gotten in contact with her. And she was like, well, you know, like, it's just that, like, they were out there shouting so loudly, and I was working with our window open. And I was working with my window open, and it was disturbing me. And it's just like, the fact that you escalated something because you were, you know what I mean? Because it was just a little annoying outside of your window is ludicrous. Like, you know what I mean?
Escalated it to calling the cops.
Right.
And as if we don't know, like, encounters with the police for people of color are very tense affairs.
Yeah.
No matter what the issue is, right?
Yeah.
But folks are so quick to pick up the phone and get like law enforcement involved. And by the way, you know where her business was or is?
What is it?
She sells.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She sells, like, medical grade marijuana things, right? Or something like that.
For, like, pets.
Oh, my gosh. That's such a, that's craziness.
It's wild. like,
that's crazy.
The privilege, you know,
like,
she's doing something that, you know, she's dealing with drugs that for a lot of people of color who hold it or sell it means the end of their civil rights.
Right.
They get locked up. They get that F for felony on forever. Right.
Yeah.
And she's just totally cool with calling the cops on a little girl on a hot day. Trying to make a dollar.
Right.
So
exactly.
Water.
Because she was uncomfortable. She was in her house. She had her window open. She had her perfect bubble world set up. And how dare anyone else's practice of their own freedom somehow infringe upon that? You know what I mean?
And, like, this is like a pattern lately, because there was another woman who called the police on black picnickers because they were too loud, right?
Yeah, sure.
What was her hashtag?
Was it Barbecue Becky or something like something like that. Yeah. It's crazy, man. You know, I feel like Black Joy is a rebellious act, man. I remember one time when I was younger, it was kind of one of the first times I was like 15 years old, and I was a bagger at Publix grocery store. It's the greatest grocery store in the world. You know, just side note. Nobody's giving me any money. Yeah, exactly. I remember my friend was a cashier, and we were just having a good time. We were completely fulfilling the role of our job, 100%. But we're just, you know, teenagers laughing, talking to each other, but not disruptive, not in a way that was out of protocol. And there was an older woman, and I can just see as she got closer, she was just seethingly frustrated with the fact that she was not the center of our world in that moment. You know what I mean?
Wow.
That she was not included. You know what I mean? That we would dare have fun and live a life that was not centered upon, like, how she felt in that moment. And it just really goes to show you that, like, man, black people being happy is a big rebellion against the system that we're born into. Just being happy.
Man.
Yes.
I love that phrase. Black joy is rebellion. We about to put that on some merch. You might see it at the next live event. But for real, man, that's why, like, when we do the five cultural artifacts thing where we just kind of run down sort of what's giving us joy or what's on our mind, so often for me it's comedy. Like, for real, like, that's life-giving. And then like just to laugh in these times, like for a lot of people, just to laugh is an right. act of rebellion. But especially with Black people just existing, like our mere existence is offensive to some people. Sure. Such that you can't sell water, you can't have a picnic, you can't go into Starbucks, you can't. There was a Black doctor who had the cops called on her, and the dude blocked her driveway, so you can't even go back to your own home. Which being Black, right? So, so in the midst of all of that, the ability to laugh and find joy and be happy in the most mundane kind of things, you know, hanging out with your partners or watching a movie or making art, whatever it is, it is in a white supremacist society, Black joy is an act of rebellion. I totally, totally feel you on that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? You know, I heard that girl came up on some Disney tickets and it's a bit ridiculous to be on the news, especially in the times that we have, because there are such heavy and important things going on. But, you know, if I think the idea that you don't have this private service, you know what I mean? They're not customer service, the police officers.
Right. Come on.
You know what I mean? The idea that that is slowly being stripped away from people. I'm all for that. Right. I'm all for that.
And it gets, I mean, the larger issue is a lot of people still think, feel, and behave as if the United States is a white person's country.
Sure.
And I know in a lot of ways it is, unjustly so, right?
Sure.
The political power, economic power, social and cultural power to an extent, right? All sort of centers whiteness. But that's not the way it should be.
For sure.
But when people believe that and act on it, you get them calling the cops on an 8-year-old selling water, right?
And
then you get all this stuff with immigration. That's been a hot topic lately. Sort of related. Like, so I don't know if this bugged you, but it with the cascade of news, I don't know if it's gotten the attention that it probably should. But the United States pulled out of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Did you see about that?
Yeah, I did see that. And it's just like at a base level, I'm not like a think tank political person. I mean, I am. First of all, everybody's political. Okay. I don't like when people say not being political is making a choice. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? So when I don't have like off the cuff of my head, I can't give you all of everybody in the House of Representatives is what I'm saying. You know, I did make some calls this week, but that's another story. But, you know, I think like I don't know what the end game is. Like I said, I wish I was more of a political minded person so I can say like, oh, like when I watch a football game, I know when they make a decision to pull a player, what their end game is. So I feel like that this is a part of a bigger play. That's crazy. You know what I mean? To say like, hey, we're not going to be a part of a Human Rights Council of the United Nations. The implications and the lack of accountability, the lack of transparency. I don't know what that opens up, but I know that it's not going to be good. You know what I mean? I know that it's not going to be something that benefits, the people who are the least of these.
Yeah.
At all.
So, I mean, I try to keep up. I don't get in depth. I just try to keep up with the headlines. And from what I understand, these are sort of ongoing issues. Number one, a lot of people, even before this administration, saw issues with the Human Rights Council and sort of the way it operated. But
definitely
under the Obama administration, they got into it and said, you know, well, we can make a bigger impact being part of it than not being part of it. And so that was part of the rationale. Sure. And then with this administration, they ostensibly withdrew because of the quote unquote anti-Israel slant of the Human Rights Council, which itself is politically loaded because, as most people know, the president declared that he was going to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv, a relatively neutral site, to Jerusalem, which is the contested capital. Right. That's what the Palestinians are fighting over, a right to the capital. And Israelis are saying, no, it's our capital. So it's a huge politically charged event. When it happened just a couple of months ago, it was a big deal. But this administration leveled those concerns a year ago. So now the timing's real interesting because Nikki Haley pulled out as soon as this border crisis, this immigration crisis of separating families sort of hit the fan. Uh-huh. And even internationally and with the UN, people are criticizing it. So it's right in the midst of that criticism that the U.S. says, okay, we're not going to be part of this Human Rights Council, which is charged with looking for violations of human rights across the globe. So don't shine a light on us. And like you said, it's isolation. So, I mean, I'm thinking of the Washington Post catchphrase, democracy dies in darkness. And just the idea that if we are not part of some entity that has that is beyond our own borders checking us when we violate human rights, then what's to stop us?
Yeah, definitely. It reminds me of the Avengers with the Sokovia Accords for
I was gonna love this.
Yeah, I know. Shout out, Bo. This is your content here. But yeah, you know, it's just like that idea of like being accountable to a larger body. And the thing is like, you know, in spite of what we might see coming up next month in July 4th. Coming around the corner, you know, the U.S. is not the Avengers. We're not Captain America. We're much, you know what I mean? We're much more flawed and fallen.
It might be like the Winter Soldier when he's under.
Right, exactly. When he does one good thing mixed with eight heinous things. Yeah. Just like, oh, sorry, I'm trapped under Russia.
Oh, my goodness. Now we got to run the post.
Exactly. But yeah, no, it is crazy. And then how quickly it was buried. Also crazy. It hasn't really been a keynote news story.
Well, so part of what buried it was sort of the last topic I want to tackle, which has been really interesting because of the questions it has raised sort of about civil rights and universal kind of human decency. So several staffers for the current administration have been heckled or even driven out of restaurants where they were eating. Stephen Miller, one of the staffer, he's only 32, but he was like the architect of the family separation policy. And was sort of in the president's ear about that. He got heckled at a restaurant. And then Kirstjen Nielsen, she got actually, she left the restaurant. She was a Mexican restaurant, ironically.
Exactly.
And she got heckled to the point where she just left. And then most recently and kind of most controversially, Sarah Sanders, the White House correspondent, she was asked to leave by the owner of a particular restaurant and then tweeted about it from her official press secretary account. The name of the restaurant might have been the owner's name too. Just specific details from this thing. So, I mean, why are people up in arms about this stuff?
I think it's interesting. And I sort of have a duality in how I feel about this particular topic. I do believe that, you know, 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, when everything was happening in the transition in the presidency, I was like, one thing that's going to happen is that this country is going to be like more politically minded than it ever has been. One thing I knew is that I was like, if Hillary gets elected, we're just going to go back to our regular lives. And I was like, but if Donald Trump gets elected, we will all be doing things and paying attention to things and knowing things that we have not done before in a political mindset. And I think with this presidency, something that we haven't seen in a long time is that the American people are saying you don't get to do certain things and then just go home and act like you didn't do what you just did. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's an accountability that extends past your 9-to-5, quote unquote. It's a bigger, we're playing with bigger stakes here, and you don't just get to separate yourself from network in that way. You don't get to, you know, do all the things you do and then clock out and then come into my restaurant and have a pot pie. Like, that's not going to work. You know what I mean? And so in that way, like, I believe in people, you know, being held accountable for their actions. We talked about that kind of earlier. We hit on it with with XXX and who he was and how he was living and how people aren't, you know, not separating the two things because it would be a fabrication. So it's just like, you know, you can't have these volatile policies and these volatile practices in office and then think that people are just going to be like, yeah, for sure. Like, you can come on our basketball court at the Y. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get to do that. And so I'm all for that accountability, but I think there becomes a line where I don't know what that line is. Like, what's the line of allowing a person to just live their lives, you know, which everybody has a right to, where we say, like, you don't, you know what I mean? Like, you have to order in under a fake name and that's it. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only way you get to do it because of how you're living your life in public. So I feel kind of broken up over it, but I am glad that people are expressing and holding people accountable and making them feel the weight of their decisions. I'm all for that.
I just want to throw in this quote from Stephanie Wilkinson, who is the owner of the restaurant where Sarah Sanders was asked to leave. And she said, "This feels like the moment in our democracy when people have to make uncomfortable actions and decisions to uphold their morals."
Yeah.
I just thought that was really profound, right? Like, and also context matters. It wasn't in Sanders' case, it wasn't just her being there, right? Oh. It was the fact that several of this restaurant staff were LGBT, and they were specifically concerned about the president's decision or push not to allow transgender folks to serve in the military. And then Sanders, of course, backed that up, supported that, all that stuff. So it was sort of specific to this issue on top of the family separation policy that had been going on. And it wasn't just, oh, you're Republican or you work for somebody I don't like. There were specific policies that sort of impacted her staff specifically, and also the broader immigration issue that had everybody, even conservative Christians who are normally in the president's corner without sort of qualification, even had them up in arms. So I just wanted to throw that out there, but I'm with you. It's not illegal. And I think part of the thing that people are conflating is, like, a lot of people are saying, okay, well, this is similar to like Jim Crow and tossing black people out, or the wedding cake and not serving homosexuals for certain things. The difference is those acts of discrimination are against whole classes of people. And it's about more sort of identity, right? Like, but these instances with officials from the current administration, they've deliberately chosen to work for this man and to support policies that across the political spectrum are seen as egregious. And so in those cases, right, like the Volitional Act and the fact that it's personal, it's not every Republican, it's not every conservative, it's a White House press secretary, right? It's people who have specific high profile elected positions, many of them, and are advocating for values and policies that contradict so much of not even just anybody's personal morals, but of what we thought America stood for, however imperfectly. So, I mean, I just wanted to throw that out there to clarify, because a lot of conversation, people talking past each other.
Definitely. Yeah, and I've seen those even happening on dating. People are saying they're having a hard time dating.
Yeah. So, I mean, so one issue is Auntie Maxine Waters, representative, she actually is calling for people to essentially protest Trump administration officials when they're out and about and you know, eating at a restaurant, shopping or whatever. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, what can you say about Auntie Maxine? Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because, like I said, like, people have a right to kind of like move around a little bit. You know what I mean? And live their lives. But I don't know. I don't know, man. I feel like, you know, I just don't think you get to do some of these things. And I think when protests have to be uncomfortable. That's the nature of a protest. It's only effective if it makes you feel uncomfortable, because through the uncomfort, is how you face the reality of whatever it is that people are protesting. You know what I mean? If it was all easy peasy, no one would ever be forced to make a decision. So I think, you know, pressure busts pipes. And so to get your point across, you can do that. I just don't want to ultimately, and I mean, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, please, but I don't know at what point, you know, you're sort of like infringing on someone's ability to be just, you know what I mean? Like live their lives and, you know, people have kids and families and
I think that's what people are protesting, right? Like some of the protesters are like, look, if kids and parents on the border can't sleep in peace, you're not going to sit up here and eat in peace because of some unjust policy,
right? right. And you have a lot of power and a lot of
live your life, driving your SUV, go to your nice soft bed, and meanwhile the policies that you are actively enforcing, sometimes lying flat out about, are ruining people's lives, not just for the present moment but for years to come, right? Like the trauma of family separation. So I think that's part of it. Also, like people got to realize this didn't happen November 2016. This is, you know, almost two years of these kinds of policies and going through the normal channels politically, you know, activism wise, and it just not having an impact. So I don't quite know where I land on whether we should be doing these kinds of things like heckling people in restaurants, but I do know that it reminds me of uprisings in the urban core, right? Like people want to get all mad at for getting out in the streets. What they don't realize is that's not the first thing people do. That's the last thing people do.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they've tried everything else. They've done it your way. They've taken the slow approach. They've compromised. They've gone through the normal legal channels and nothing has gotten through. And so that's what I think. And one of the things that just looking at social media and reading, you know, op-ed pieces, I'm just like, people really think this is about blue and red. It's not. Is so much bigger than Democrat or Republican. Because guess what? We've had Republican presidents before. We've had Democrat presidents before. But this kind of thing in our recent history is new. You know, why is that? That's because this particular administration, this particular president, and what is bringing out, what it is enabling. I'm not saying it created stuff that it wasn't already there, but it's paved the way for this level of bigotry and callousness that people are just fed up.
Right. Definitely. Definitely.
They're like, what are you supposed to do?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I agree. It's way bigger. It's way bigger than partisan politics. And it's way, it's very frustrating. I know you're very active, on Twitter, and I'm very active on social media as well. And I, especially when it came to this issue, I sort of feel like we've reached the peak of, or I hope that we soon reach the peak of these sort of diversionary tactics and our arguments and things like that. I don't think people are being honest. And so like what I mean is like, you know, like you were talking about what administration enacted these policies and da 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 da. And there's truth to that stuff and there is a forum for that. But at the end of the day, like, you know, who made a person hungry is not more important than that person is hungry right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
right. So it's like, that's kind of like where my mind is at with a lot of stuff. You know, you hear these people, you know, that are just like, well, you know, there were slaves in Africa. Did you know? You know what I mean? And it's just like, okay, like, you know, let's go down a path where this, where that statement is not diversionary and it's completely, honest and what does that have to do with what happened in America? How does that change anything? You know what I mean? Because it doesn't. Exactly. It doesn't change anything. You're deflecting from what the matter is. So I really wish, I think we could get so much more done if we would stop with that. Like there's a forum for that stuff and that's important. And I think, that forum is in the creation of our textbooks and the way we're educated and things like that. Like we need to know what is right and what is true and timely. You know what I mean? But and then when it comes to the immediacy of the impact of dealing with, the hurts of people, especially people in the most vulnerable situations, it's just like, we don't have time for that. You know what I mean? Like we don't have time for that. Like the hour that we just spent, you know, you know, going back through the scrolls is an hour that, you know, a child is suffering a massive emotional and mental trauma that is almost undoable because of how old they are. You know what I mean? Like, we got to work on that.
And then immediately.
Even though
they signed the executive order, we got to get these families back together immediately, as soon as possible.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that's part of, you know, the urgency behind people. I mean, I know I would be extremely uncomfortable as I was a business owner and one of these top officials came in, right? Like, these people are recognizable on the street because they're so prominent in the administration. So it's not just like, you know, some intern who happens to work in this administration. These are people who are actively they're the spokespeople for these egregious policies. I know I would be, I might ask them to leave. I mean, I know if I was a customer, I surely would leave. Sure. But I don't think people are gonna handle it right if we've got politicians on one side calling for protests at, you know, private establishments of politicians on the other side. I just don't think people are gonna handle that responsibly. There's gonna be a reaction, right? Like,
right? Yeah, that's a very good word. Yeah, and then, you know, the whole economic system is basically becomes like a political. You know what I mean?
I don't think just that's like, necessarily gonna happen because green is bigger than blue and red. But I do think that there are going to be some folks on the other side who try to come to the defense of these officials. And I don't really want to see what they're going to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no reason that, you know, that Sarah Sanders published the name of the owner in that restaurant, but to try to punish them. Man. You know what I mean?
That gets scary. That gets really scary. And I just think it does. I mean, as Christians, right? Like, what's really tricky about this political moment is it can and has divided the church in so many ways, like on a micro level within congregations. I mean, I've experienced this definitely. And it's not so much, oh, you support this president or whatever. It's just that I feel like my concerns as a minority have fallen on deaf ears within the household of God.
Yeah, definitely.
And where you're supposed to listen and empathize. And when one part of the body hurts, we all hurt. One suffers, we all suffer. And that's just being like totally disregarded. And I imagine people on the other side, you know, feel like, well, I have a right to my preferences and all that stuff. But I just think, I mean, people are being hurt. Like, power is being preserved from one point of view. But then on the other side, that power is harming people who have less power. And that's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, like, for sure. Definitely. And I it's tough because in the church, I think one of the big problems is that we're using words, but people are interpreting them differently between each other. You know what I mean? And so it's just like, you know, there is, and I mean, there's only one Jesus, but there's multiple Jesus in the U.S. church. You know, there's Chad Jesus. Chad Jesus is the Jesus of Permit Patty and $100,000 a year and white picket fence. And I got saved and nothing bad ever happens to my family. And we all got college degrees. And, you know, Chad Jesus, that's the Jesus of that thing. And there's another Jesus who, you know, is the one who, you know, who's the one who was forced to, you know, be born in a manger, and the one who is of a certain ilk and who was there for the least of these and was in the broken and dark places. And that those Jesuses can't be reconciled against each other. And we have a country of people who have only learned one way. They haven't learned that, like, they've learned that you go on a mission trip, you fly across the world and you take photos, you know what I mean? And you like do a little digging for a week. You get all your shots, you do your digging, and then you come back. And then there's people who realize that like, you know, that's all around us all the time. You know what I mean? The people who need the water of life, the people who need, you know, new systems to be educated and have access to resources and all that stuff. And, until we delineate between the two and get to the pure, true God and what he says, we're speaking to each other and we're saying words, but they have different meanings to each other. I see that all the time. I'm like, how can we talk about you know, because I'm like, yo, grace, we're talking about grace. And they're like, yeah, like, you know what I mean? It's just like, we're not even interpreting these things the same. You know what I mean? And that, how can we even begin to effectively communicate with each other when people aren't even processing the words the right way?
We need to get back to, everybody likes Jesus the Savior, but we need to get back to the suffering Savior.
Yeah.
In the American church,
right,
particularly in terms of like white evangelicalism, doesn't know how to suffer well. The Black church has a lot of experience with that.
No.
These migrants who are coming, many of them are Christian, and they have a lot of experience with that. They're fleeing persecution in many cases, and even if not outright violent persecution, the sort of the level of economic disenfranchisement they have is enough to say, let me pick up everything and move away from everything I know and go toward a land that is risky for me even to get into, let alone succeed in. So that's some real economic hardship. But so much of the church in America is the church triumphant rather than the church on the way, right? Like, we want to be the church in the promised land with all of our enemies cast out and just stay there, plant it, and defend our borders. But in reality, we're still a church that's wandering in the wilderness. We're still a church that's on the way, and our final home isn't America. Thank God, right? Like, that would be a really low goal.
Right. Yeah.
Sort of, bad reward compared to heaven. So our goal is heaven.
Here's Ohio. You made it.
Exactly. No shade on Ohio, but it's not heaven. No,
for sure.
So yeah, man, no easy answers to any of this, but hopefully just like if we could talk even on the mic.
For sure. I do want to toss an aside in really quick if I may.
Yeah, go for it.
Just being from South Florida, the experience with immigration is a lot more ground level. It's so much, you know, you see it, you touch it in the South in a way that you don't in a lot of other places. And the idea that the people who come from other countries are not the best, quote unquote. First of all, it's crazy because, you know, going back to deifying humanity, like, who are we to be like, oh, we only want other places, best of the best is who deserves to be here. That's ridiculous because America isn't full of the best of the best people. Right. You know what I mean? You can just run to like any 7-Eleven anywhere and you'll figure it out really quick. But the idea that a person who is being persecuted, right, would have the, cause they're people as well. You know what I'm saying? And so we know what it's like to be a person because we are also that. The fact that they would have the strength to leave a place where everyone they know is, right? To go to a place where they may not know the language, so you can't effectively communicate. They have no means of supporting themselves. You know what I mean? They have no idea what the future holds or what the journey will entail, and they're still willing to do that because they believe that through that journey they might come out on the other side okay, makes them the best. You know what I'm saying? Bro, people don't leave their hometown in America. They won't move to, you know what I'm saying, they scared to leave their crib to go to another American city. You know what I mean? So it's just like, don't tell me that a person who is willing to go under, over, through, swim, you know what I mean? Whatever. Don't tell me that that person isn't cut from a different cloth, because they are. You know what I mean? I talk about that with my friends a lot. It's just like when it comes to movies, we watch, like, say, The Walking Dead, right? We watch this show and we all love to believe that we're the main characters. But really, most of us are just the zombies that populate that area. You know what I'm saying? We all can't be the main characters. That's not how stories work. You know what I mean? And so the people who have the juice to make these trips, they are the main kid. You know what I'm saying? Like, they didn't, they're not lazy. They're not whatever. They did whatever they had to do. And that in and of itself should be enough to just be like, you know, let's give this dude a look, man. You know what I mean?
Like,
let's
made
give
it like, yeah, that what?
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah. So that's just like a little aside that I get like a little wound up about.
Man, no doubt. I mean, these are real people. And I don't think any of us who haven't been through it really realize the level of sacrifice, determination, risk that it takes. So let's at least treat them humanely.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Keep the babies with the parents. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. And so clearly solidified that we have to have you on again. We've loved having you on the Pass the Mic live tour. So if you come, we're going to be in Atlanta for our next one. Go to passthemiclive.com and you can order your tickets and see where we're going to end up next. We've got two or three more stops this year. So we would love to see you out there. And if you do come, you can meet Adam in person. So maybe this is the first time you've heard him, but it definitely won't be the last. Appreciate you joining us, brother.
Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely. We'll see you soon on the next Pass the Mic.